Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast, and I am your host, Alex Schumacher. When you close your eyes and think of the word home, what do you see? Maybe you see a house or a person. Maybe it's a city. Maybe even one that you haven't lived in years. Or maybe it's not even a city, person, or place. Maybe it's just a feeling, security, or safety. Whatever it is that you picture or feel when you think of home, it's probably very unique and specific to you. This week on Real College Podcast, we take you into three very different and very specific pictures of what we think of when we think of home. Starbucks, trash, and more, all on this episode of Real College Podcast. Every hometown has some weird, random structure or location that, in the eyes of the locals, comes to define that place. For example, for my hometown, it was a 10-foot statue of a guy bending a metal rod. We called him Mr. Bendo. And for producer Nathan Fervoy, when he thinks of his hometown of Evanston, Illinois, he thinks of a giant pile of trash. Nathan has more.
Well, my sensations are picking up. Is I see a lot of green, a big, massive hill that doesn't look like trash very much. I see tennis courts right in front of me as we approach it. The soccer goals, people walking by, a lawnmower coming over, picking up young lawnmower
trees.
Stuff,
old
and
trees.
A lot of trees in the hill. Hilly section, the trash mori section.
A well-known landmark in Evanston in North Chicagoland, Mount Trashmore stands out as the only elevated ground for miles around. The man-made hill attracts the younger members of the community year-round for its views, recreation, and for a chance to speed down its steep sides.
All right, Mount Trashmore, it's pretty weak, to be honest. It's like the highest in the air you can get in the state of Illinois. And it used to be made out of trash, so there's hella diapers in here and shit. And they just covered it in dirt. They covered it in dirt, and now there's some grass growing on and some trees. And I once tried to plant a weed plant here when I was like 15. And it didn't work at all because I forgot where I planted it. I like put a piece of trash, and I was like, I'll remember this piece of trash. And I remember it, so this shit's pretty weak, but the view is like nice. It's like a 4 out of 10. You could see like a third. You could see like a third of the park from here, and the train tracks, and Home Depot.
Over here, though, that's pretty sick view.
Yeah, you can actually see Chicago a little bit. You can see Chicago. I can see the Sears Tower from here, which is pretty cool, but it's real tiny.
My name is Bob Dorniker. I'm with the city's Parks and Recreation Department. My role here at the city is I am the Assistant Director of Parks, Recreation, and Community Services. I've actually worked for the city for over 25 years in various capacities, and I work for one of the greatest departments in the city, Parks and Recreation, Quality of Life Department. James Park was once a city trash dump way back, and I believe the city actually purchased a property in 1948, used it for a trash dump for a number of years, and then in 1970s, it actually put together a plan to develop the site into a public park, and that's actually our largest park site here in Evanston for athletic fields. As part of that development, the city actually built a large 65-foot tall sledding hill, and when they first started putting it together back in the late 70s, early 80s, there was actually toboggan slides there at the site, as well as tow ropes. It was like a mini ski resort. You were able to actually rent skis at a field house that was constructed, and you could go check them in and out for the day.
I remember there was the big hill in the middle, and the medium hill, and then the small hill, and then the big hill, someone broke their neck on the fence in between the two hills, and then it was like a $2,000 fine for a year and a half if you went on the big hill. That's what I remember, just sledding.
Damn, people still sled though. So.
Yeah. I remember going down the backside of this very hill.
The backside is the suicide side.
And ramming into a fence.
Someone broke their neck down.
On Ty's tube.
Yeah.
And it was real fun.
Someone died.
So it's really changed over the years. One of the things that's happened is that the toboggan slides are gone. All of the tow ropes are gone. We no longer even had to go back to, you know, when we were doing the skiing out there. We actually had snow making equipment there. That's all been removed. And it's actually, the hill itself is more of a passive space now. Some individuals will run the hill during the summer and spring months for training purposes. Now it's turned into more of a nature area, and actually individuals...
Along with the untamed nature, which filled in the passive space left in the absence of winter sports, came a long line of untamed teenagers, a tribe, bored and looking for a place outside the bounds of regular society to go about their business. In the brambles behind the hill, bushes and branches block out the outside world, obscuring away the problems of those who visit. And in the same moment, sunlight streaming in between the leaves, Mount Trashmore presents a new and better reality for the mind to wander through, a reality of smoke and friends, community and hope.
Here, should we go? Which way should we go?
Let's go up around where the hangout is.
Yeah.
It's sort of a knowing place. Like, I feel like the hill knows.
Uh-huh.
Like, the hill has eyes. Not in a creepy way, but in a cool way.
I'll go over there on bad days and good days too, you know, or whatever. Sit like Humpty Dumpty on that wall, and these people look at me like I got big wings, like Paul. How you doing, lady?
I'm good. What's up?
It was the spot. We all lived in South Evanston.
Yeah.
I don't really know why we started. You lived the closest.
I live at the very first house right after the train tracks. So we used to chill all the time at Mount Trashmore. And it was pretty much a normal park until you got to the hill. And then in the hill, it was just like a whole different forest. And like each different spots in each different direction were like very distinct.
It was a maze, dude.
Yeah.
Like once it grew in, it was just so hard to, you couldn't really walk through it. But when, like we were in there in the fall.
I remember having shown him some sketches that I made of Mount Trashmore, specifically the hill, and it was just like a bunch of people dancing around. It was like a bunch of different symbolism in there too, different things going on in different parts of the hill. And like, I don't know, we started talking about a summer camp kind of like music creativity festival thing where every summer people just set up, you know, tents, yurts, whatever the fuck they want. They just set it up on Mount Trashmore, and then like all summer long it's just kind of an event of creativity. Doesn't matter what you do, it's like art, music, dancing, clothes, whatever the hell you think your talent is. You just camp out there, you just support everybody else. It's kind of like, it's kind of just like a summer long of community.
That was the idea.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of people in our generation should continue to go after that vision that we had of Mount Trashmore, you know what I'm saying? Because it's like...
But what was that really? Like we were just high as hell on acid all the time.
But think about the homies at the time, though. Also, you know what I'm saying? Think about how much we all were a community, in a way. You know what I'm saying? It wasn't like one man for one. It was all for all. And it definitely wasn't like, I would take a bullet for you. But at the same time, it
we
was
were
like
very community. We had to share everything.
I think
we had.
I think that it should just be used for more than what it's used now. Especially the hill space. The hill space is very neglected. Every other space kind of has something designated to it, but that hill space, you know, without littering it or destroying it, I think people should, you know, come together and do events on the hill also. That would be something crazy.
What brought me into this world, sort of like those times.
I could almost smell the vibe. Almost smell the vibe, dude. It's so fucking nice. It's just like coming back to an old friend.
Uh-huh.
Like smelling it, seeing it, and soon I'll be touching it, walking up it. It's like coming back to a nice place that resonates with me.
For Real College Podcast, this is Nathan Curry.
In contrast to a giant hill made out of garbage, what's the least interesting or unique thing you can think of to associate with a hometown? It might very well be a Starbucks. Well, because they're not especially known for being unique. But for one East Metro suburb, the number of Starbucks is sort of what makes it stand out. Austin Maculis comes to us with this tale of too many Starbucks while reporting from his hometown.
I grew up in Woodbury, a suburb just outside St. Paul. I usually tell people that Woodbury is just like every other suburb. There's rows of single-family homes, large shopping centers, and of course, an abundance of overpriced coffee chains, namely Starbucks. But Woodbury's affection for Starbucks goes beyond the typical. The city, home to just under 70,000 residents, has 7 Starbucks coffee shops. That's about 1 for every 10,000 residents. There's 3 standalone stores, 4 attached to grocery chains, 2 stores are directly across from one another in the same parking lot. Now, I like Starbucks just as much as the next caffeine addict. But 7? That's got to be way too many, right? But according to Carl Batalden, the city's economic and housing development coordinator, it's a matter of economics.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the market. You know, these are market-driven decisions.
Unlike some localities, Batalden says that Woodbury does not offer tax breaks or subsidies based on the type of business.
We can guide land uses, we have zoning regulations, but we never control or regulate which business goes where.
That means national chains like Starbucks can take advantage of Woodbury's affluent consumer base, which is only expected to grow. The city's population has increased 12% since 2010, according to census estimates. That means more people spending money to get their coffee fix.
I commute to Stillwater now, and the Starbucks is right on the way.
Claire, a teacher who lives in Woodbury, has become a Starbucks regular.
Okay, it's bad. The past 3 weeks, it's been finals week, so I've come pretty much every day.
Ellen, who's lived in Woodbury for about 2.5 years, appreciates the convenience, especially with her kids.
A lot of times we'll go to the ones that are in the grocery stores, like Kowalski's and Jerry's.
Okay.
Just because they also have like a bakery, so if you're looking for breakfast and stuff, and they also have a lot more seating. So for little kids, it's a lot nicer to take them and know you're going to get a seat.
And then there's also the proximity.
There's one like within a mile of us at any given moment when we're here, so that's nice.
A lot of Starbucks customers have a preference for their favorite store. That includes my mother, a Woodbury resident, and let's be honest, a Starbucks addict.
I found that I got the best service at Kowalski's, and I got the best drink at Kowalski's. They knew exactly how I liked it.
She goes to the Kowalski's Starbucks nearly every day, sometimes twice a day, and she's really particular with her drink.
It is a Trenta black iced tea, no water, because I like it strong, and no sweetener, and shaken really well.
But even for her, the number of Starbucks in Woodbury is, well...
I would say it's a little on the high side, yes.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Austin Maculis.
Finally, at the beginning of the episode, I said that maybe rather than thinking of a specific place when you think of your hometown, you have a very specific feeling. Now, sometimes this feeling might be good, a cozy feeling, say. But, well, sometimes the feeling you associate with home is not a good feeling. For the final story on this episode, I talk about my conflicted feelings towards my home state of South Dakota. The 4-hour drive from Minneapolis to my hometown of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, is not what one would call interesting. It mostly consists of prairie, soybean, and cornfields. And yet, I come to find that there's something beautiful in the endless flat landscape that I've come to associate with home. Towards the end of a recent drive back, I point out a particularly beautiful section of the drive to my boyfriend. It consists of a bright green field with trees rising up a small hill. He tells me that he sees that it's beautiful, but also doesn't quite get it. But he adds, "I suppose when you spend your entire life surrounded by something, you have to learn to see the beauty in it." Though Sioux Falls is my hometown, I often find myself thinking of all of South Dakota as my home. This is easy when you consider the fact that the population of the Twin Cities metro area is more than 4 times that of all of South Dakota. Yeah, we don't even have 1 million people. When talking about South Dakota, I catch myself using words like "we," as if I've come to represent all South Dakotans. I think this is something that anyone born and raised in one of those empty Midwest states who then runs off to a big city finds themselves doing. You become the unwilling representative of a place you've run away from, a place you don't even really like. In high school, my friends and I would share stories of the ridiculous questions people from the coast had asked us upon learning that we were from South Dakota. Yes, we do have electricity. No, we do not ride buffalo to school. Nobody does that. Yes, we do have the internet. And yes, we do watch TV. For God's sakes, we might be tiny, but we're still Americans. I don't get those same questions now when I tell people I'm from South Dakota. Now questions tend to lean more in the direction of, what was it like and how did you survive? If I had to guess, the politics of the last few years has wiped away any illusions of what the Midwest is. Stories of my state trying to ban things like abortion, trying to keep refugees from settling there, and attempting to legalize discrimination against LGBT people like me has certainly stripped away the notion of it as a cozy homeland. More and more people are seeing it for what I learned that it was. A small town blown up to state level, a place that could be filled with suspicion, guarded against difference. I wish I could categorize my feelings towards South Dakota as something as neat as just hate. It might be true that I don't like South Dakota, but I do like Sioux Falls. It's a mini city of 150,000. And over time, it came to feel like a respite against the larger storm of the state as a whole. It has a burgeoning art scene and small coffee shops and strange stores that proudly declare that all are welcome in their windows. It can feel at its best like a tiny Minneapolis. And to say that I hate South Dakota as a whole doesn't sit quite right. Maybe disappointed is a better word. See, South Dakota and states like it try to sell themselves for their small charms. It's a place where you don't have to lock your doors at night, a place where neighbors watch out for each other. And as much as these concepts are just myths, they're based on something true. There is a sense of community, a generosity that does run across my entire state. I felt it. So then, it hurts when that generosity, that kindness, turns in on itself and becomes an excuse to rail and scream against the other. I want to know where it said that we had to be exclusive, closed-minded. I find myself now watching from Minneapolis, hoping that things will change there, continuously disappointed when they don't. You'll learn to see the beauty in anything. I grew up next to a cornfield. I'd watch it turn from gray to green to gold, then yellow, and finally to white, before going back to gray again as the seasons cycled around. Like me, most of my friends fled South Dakota after high school, because like me, most of my friends felt like an outsider stuck in a community that prized insiders. And in this way, I assume that most of my friends, like me, also watch South Dakota now with a mixture of hate, disappointment, and hope. I think that, like me, they watch South Dakota and hope that the good that they genuinely saw when they lived there will someday, in the end, defeat the ugly that so often seems to rear its head. I'm watching. I'm waiting. Hoping that one day, the beauty I know I saw there will make itself more apparent to all. That's all for this week's episode of Real College Podcast. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It is produced by Liv Riggins, Ben Hallam, and Nathan Fervoy. Yours truly, Alex Schumacher, is the host and managing editor of Real College Podcast. You can download and listen to all of our episodes at RadioK.org or wherever you get your podcasts. That's all for Real College Podcast this week. See you around.